Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So, for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always. That's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away by the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, films manage to get made. Now, what you've happened upon here is one of my occasional special episodes of the podcast where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their latest release and stroke or their body of work. And in this particular instance, I'm delighted to welcome director Philip Martin to the Film Stories podcast. Now, at the point we're recording, his most recent production, 2024 Scoop, has just been released on Netflix. This is the story of Prince Andrew's infamous interview with the BBC's Newsnight programme. And there are a few names that come up through the conversation you're about to hear. Writer Peter Moffat, for instance, and members of the cast, including Gillian Anderson, Keely Hawes, Billy Piper, Rufus Sewell. They're all mentioned throughout the chat. We also briefly, the name of Sam McAllister comes up a few times. Now, Sam McAllister is the author of the book that Scoop is based on, which is called Scoops Behind the Scenes, the BBC's most shocking interviews. And she also was the reporter, producer, who doggedly tracked down the Prince Andrew interview for the Newsnight programme and has been involved in the production as well. I think that's all you need to know going into this. So, as always, what I'm going to do, I'm going to set it up with a clip from the trailer from the film, and then we'll come to my conversation with Philip Martin, recorded over Zoom, so do bear that in mind when listening to the audio, the other side of this.
An hour of television can change everything.
Three women and a whippet. Wouldn't have seen that in a BBC studio when I started.
The allegations surrounding Jeffrey Epstein include his friend Prince Andrew.
Sam,
let's stop pushing the palace.
I want it for us.
You're chasing a story that we're never going to get.
This is the work.
My job is booking the people we can't just call up.
Hello, everyone.
You have a problem that won't go away.
We're looking at options. But there is a red line.
I've never been smuggled into a palace before.
If I do an interview, the question is, why you?
With respect, you know how people see you.
Spell it out.
Randy Andy.
with respect.
That was a clip from the trailer for Scoop, and I am delighted to be joined for a Film Stories podcast special by its director, Philip Martin. Philip Martin, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, how are you, Simon?
I am all right, thank you very much. I've had a slightly less frantic weekend than I'd imagine you've had with the release of your new film. But before we get there, I wonder, because ahead of this podcast, I try and dig into kind of what got people to where they are. And I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the film, but not an awful lot about you. So I get to interrogate you for a little bit. And
great.
The earliest credit I can find for you from assorted reliable internet sources is 1995 Shoot for the Moon. And I'm just wondering what got you to that point. What was the ambition? Was this something you always wanted to do?
Yes, I did. I always liked to draw and to paint, and I always liked to write.
Okay.
And so I was always interested in the visual world and also in trying to tell stories. And I started originally a million years ago. I was a music journalist for a bit, and then I started to read scripts. I had a whole bunch of friends who were in the I was living in Canada. I had a whole lot of friends who were in the film industry over there, and we were all freelance, trying to earn money. And a lot of people made a little bit of money by script reading, so you would read a script and get paid a little bit of money for doing a report on it. And so I started to read scripts and, became interested in how you tell stories through scripts. And, you know, you read a lot of scripts, and the way that script reading goes is, you know, the options are kind of, you know, not let's make this, but, you know, is it possibly worth having, another read of this script? So it's that you suddenly realize how many scripts get produced and how few scripts get made. And that all seemed just the process of it all. Another thing about living in Canada was that there was much more of an industry over there, in some ways a viable industry, than there is here. So, you know, my friends who were, we were all just starting out down the road, but they were getting runner jobs on films, and that just seemed not to exist over here in that way. So that just seemed really, a viable way to connect the things that I was interested in, visual world and photography and painting and the written world and storytelling. And when I came back to England, I started to see how I could get into it. And I eventually managed to find a way in through documentaries. And I started to do a lot of documentaries, and I've done English at university. So I was very much on the arts side of things, but for various weird reasons that, you know, your career shapes, someone offers you a job and you do the job, you know, I found myself doing a lot of science documentaries. I got very interested in science because it seemed such a kind of, such a different world. And, the parameters of it were so interesting. And then for other reasons why, you know, you never know these things, I suddenly found myself doing a lot of cosmology stuff and space and the, you know, the origins of the universe. And then I did a big documentary series with Stephen Hawking about the origins of the universe, and a factual series. He then, I thought it would be interesting to make a film of his life, and he was confident that I understood enough of the science to give it the go ahead. And so that was the first drama that I did. That was how I crossed
That's
over.
Hawking, yeah.
Was
2004.
Hawking. That's right. Yeah. With Benedict Cumberbatch. And,
yes, his first screen role, if I've got that right.
Yeah, I think he'd been in a few sort of tiny things before, but this is his first big sort of big one, and obviously he's amazing talent, and sort of had such a great handle on the part and how to play it, and right from the beginning. So he was a joy to work with, and so that was the first thing, the sort of first conventional BBC drama, if you like, that I did. And then I went, you know, that sort of got me off to the races.
I love the fact that on a lot of the press notes for this, your builder's Philip Martin brackets The Crown.
Yeah,
and that's it. And looking at the background of the things you do, I mean, you talk about coming from an arts background, and then, I mean, one of the science things you did, of course, was Double Helix, the DNA years, which you also wrote that, I think. I mean, that was...
Yes.
I mean, that's fairly full on to go in the other direction.
It was full on, and it was, I think it was... I know it was to do with the anniversary of the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, and it was, I suppose, that was again a very sort of interesting ideas behind it all, which were that, I suppose, has the discovery of DNA changed the way we think about what it means to be human, and how and where our humanity comes from, and how we sort of partly the sort of nature nurture thing, how we humans come to be the way that we are, and whether we inherit our, you know, characteristics through our biology, or whether they're sort of, you know, so it was a very sort of, it was super interesting. And I suppose, I find in drama, I find a lot of these sort of ideas, if you like, sort of bubble through it. And it's made me, look out for projects where, I suppose, sometimes I think I'm trying to make a documentary, but with sort of a wildlife documentary, but with humans in it. You know, I love the idea that.
Oh, I like that.
I'm interested in, I suppose, in behavior and in, you know, why people do things. And certainly with Scoop, you know, one of the things that we really, I guess, focused on is so much of the storytelling is visual storytelling. So much of people's reaction to the original Andrew interview was not only what he said, but how he acted, and his body language, and how he responded emotionally in his physicality to the questions that Emily was asking him, and how Emily presented herself. And so that's something, I suppose, I'm very interested in my work is sort of human behavior, I suppose, and observing that. And obviously with Scoop, the lovely thing, the acting is so, the actors that we had were so amazing. You know, we were able to give space, I think, for a lot of those, for a lot of that sort of, if you like, allowing people to see behavior, allowing the acting to sort of tell a different story sometimes to what the words are saying.
I spoke to James Hawes earlier in the year, who directed One Life, of course, with Anthony Hopkins, and he talked about going into that project and how almost double-edged sword it was that you already know the ending, that you know that the ending of your story is very strong, but also you know that everybody else knows that the ending of your story is very strong. And I'm just wondering how you and Peter Moffat went to counterbalance that, because watching the opening scene of Scoop, really exciting sequence through Central Park in New York, was probably about the last thing I was expecting your film to kick off with. And I just wonder if you could take me into yours and Peter's conversations there.
Well, we talked a lot about this, and obviously, as you say, you know, the audience knows the end of the story. I suppose what we tried to do was to take you there, but when you're there, to allow you to have new eyes to see that that end with new eyes. And also, one of the things that we added in the film, or we explored in the film, which I think is really powerful, is that although it's a complete no-brainer now that the interview was a disaster for Andrew and didn't certainly achieve what he wanted it to achieve, and I think, you know, I think it's definitely true that the Newsnight people when they left the palace, the Newsnight team knew they had something amazing on their hands. But actually, you never really know what you have until it reaches the outside world. And in some ways, the film, the interview that Emily did, the amazing interview, gets catalyzed by its kind of contact with the outside world. And it's the sort of social media and the audience reactions to it that really, if you like, complete it and turn it into what it's become, this sort of iconic moment. And so we wanted to explore that and just in some ways what drama can do is take you into the headspace of all of the characters. And so to put you into Andrew's world as he realizes that the interview hasn't done what he wanted it to do, to put you into Sam's world as she, you know, it has gone through this extraordinary experience. And then she's thinking, well, what was that all about? What did it add up to? What did it mean? So, and I think that's what, in some ways, we were talking earlier about documentary and drama. I think what documentary can do is to give you information and in some ways in an emotional way, but ultimately to give you new information to process. And I think what drama can give you is a new emotional perspective. It can give you new eyes. It can put you into someone's head. And I suppose that's what we tried to do with the film, so that yes, you could revisit the interview, but you could revisit it from the multiple perspectives of all of the people in the room, and somehow we could put our audience in the room and allow them to feel what it felt like to be there.
I mean, I read Sam McAllister's book pretty much as it came out before I knew that there was a film of this coming. And amongst the many things I love about the book is before you get to the chapters on the Prince Andrew interview, there's the chapter on Steven Seagal walking out of an interview. So if you're looking to like do an anthology of these, I'm fascinated to see what you're going to do with that. But there's lots of there's three chapters in the book based just on this interview. And there's little details in there that were crucial to the investigation but not crucial to your drama as I see it. So one of them being Prince Andrew doing an interview actually with ITV along the original lines of what he wanted to do, which struck me when I'm reading it as a monumental turning point in the story. But in terms of the economy of the story you're looking to tell, you and Peter Moffat are very, very selective, and understandably so, in the details you go for. What was informing those choices? Were you looking to make sure that, for instance, this didn't become a three, four-hour film? Were you looking for this to be a contained start-to-finish feature?
Absolutely. And I think that is it's such a good point these days where the wonderful innovation, technological innovation of streaming that's happened over the last 10 or 15 years has allowed a kind of novelization of storytelling, which is brilliant for episodic TV, but a film isn't a novel. A film is a short story, and in some ways you have to use a different analogy. You have to get the plane up in the air quite quickly. You have to fly it somewhere interesting, and then you have to land it, you know, all within 90 minutes to 2 hours. And obviously in a longer TV shaped project, you could have perhaps a subplot between the BBC and ITV trying to get the interview or whatever. But I think in this, you have to make tough choices in a film. You have to sort of cut away the extraneous bits of the story that don't necessarily fit into the path that you're choosing. You know, different people will choose to go through the story in different ways, and this is the way that we chose. And yes, there's a lot of, to-ing and fro-ing about the terms on which Newsnight would accept an interview with the palace and their red lines and so on. And I think that, it's just sometimes too complicated, and partly too complicated, but also, the more stuff you have that isn't directly feeding into your central narrative, I think the more you not only add, but you also dilute your central narrative. It's just not, it's not possible to have the same level of character depth in the areas that you choose if you're having, you know, the more kind of story strands you introduce. So, so we tried to keep it as focused as we could.
I speak to quite a few filmmakers, and they talk about the alchemy of why projects come together at a certain point in your career, at a point where you're in a position to be able to do it. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that I think has been lost in a bit of the conversation about Scoop is this, if I've got this right, is your third collaboration with Peter Moffat.
That's right.
That you did Hawking and you did Einstein and Eddington. If you hadn't have done those two before, would that have made this tougher? Because if I got this as well, the timing on this seemed relatively streamlined. I mean, 2 years start to finish is relatively brisk for a feature film. I'm just wondering if you had a shorthand between you as a result of those previous experiences.
I think we probably did. Peter's an amazing writer. He's got a really brilliant, gift for, if you like, taking complicated story and making it dramatic and propulsive. And yeah, we'd worked on this very, again, you know, a science story, a very complex story, very interesting story about the relationship between a British scientist called Arthur Eddington and Einstein during the First World War, actually. And there was a solar eclipse yesterday, and it was the thing about, one of the things about our story with Einstein and Eddington was that it was Eddington's observations of an eclipse that allowed the physical proof of one of Einstein's theories or it allowed him to actually caused Einstein to question his own theory and realize that his theory was slightly wrong and to adjust it as a result of it. But it was complicated but very emotional territory, and very deep, very deeply emotional territory. And Peter's really brilliant at all of that sort of stuff. And Peter used to be a lawyer as well, and so he's very good at kind of marshalling all of the, if you like, the narrative information in a story like this, which is quite complex. And it was definitely it was probably a good thing that we'd worked together before, and it was great to work together again.
And no raging punch-ups between the two of you behind the scenes.
No.
Nice and peaceful, and cups of tea.
No, of course, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, your own move into film, I appreciate it's a very blurry line between film and TV. I mean, I'm just looking for like key moments in your career. And I read an interview with John Travolta of you jumping on a plane, going from Europe to the US to meet him about possibly directing the film that became The Forger. And I read the interview, and John Travolta's telling this in a very matter-of-fact way. And then I tried to put myself in your head what that would be like on the eve of directing a film with a major Hollywood star, which would be your feature directorial debut. That can't be just another day at the office. I'm just wondering what the person who got on that plane was going through.
It's a funny one with this world because, you have to... You have to really give every moment like that 100% of your self-belief and you go from meeting about a script, and you really have to give everything to it, and you have to believe that it's going to happen. And I think sometimes that's the job of the director, is to sort of convince everybody that it is possible to make the film that everyone else is thinking might not be possible to make. Maybe you get a phone call a couple of days later and they tell you that you haven't got the job. So it is a weird job in that sense, that you sort of have to go into situations with a lot of conviction and with and think around it, and sometimes you find an emotional connection with a project, and you think, okay, well, this is the bit of it that I'm interested in, and this is where I can bring something maybe that someone else couldn't. But yeah, no, it's a John's an amazing performer and amazing talent, amazing, a legendary, obviously a legendary person, great and wonderful, wonderful to work with. It was great fun.
Must have been just from the outside looking in, that's a terrifying plane ride because it's just the weight.
Yes,
sure. Yes. I mean, once you're in the room, I'd imagine it's fine, but the hours knowing what you're going to do and what you're going to pitch for, do you ever get used to that?
No, I don't. I think you probably stay kind of mildly terrified about everything all the time. And I think usually when you're in filmmaking, if there's a day that you think is going to, you know, on set that you think you've got covered and it's going to be quite straightforward, it very quickly turns into a complete sort of disaster. And quite often there are days where you think, I don't think we're going to get this. And suddenly something happens and you do get it and everything comes together very quickly. And there's a mysterious sort of magic at the process, at the heart of filmmaking, that is, I think, probably what keeps us all sort of hooked to it. You're sort of trying to catch something, you're trying to pursue something, and I think you all know when you've got it. There was a wonderful moment where in Scoop, where we were all, the way the schedule worked is that we didn't do the interview first thing. Just because of schedule and availability and locations and all of that sort of thing. And then a couple of weeks into the shoot, Rufus and Gillian, came together in this room and we filmed the interview, and we all sort of knew, but we didn't want to say that if the interview didn't work, then we didn't really have a film. And you're in a set, a big set that we built, and we're watching, and Rufus is sitting down and Gillian's sitting down, and I'd had this idea, which, often your ideas aren't any good, but this turned out to be a sensible idea, which was that the original interview in the script had been written as a series of short scenes, as you intercut between one setup or one location and another, you intercut between, and so we just joined all of the interview scenes together, and we filmed it as one. We filmed it in 20 minute takes, doing the whole interview as one long thing. And we were all, sitting around, lots and lots of people who've been on lots and lots of film sets, and suddenly you see that magic start to happen between Julian and Rufus, and the interviews coming to light, and you've had weeks of conversations about costume and prosthetics and set design, and we matched the room, we copied the carpet, we did all of these sort of technical things, we matched the BBC's camera setups, every sort of technical physical thing that we could, we replicated in our own way. But in the end, you need something needs to breathe life into all of that, and suddenly the Rufus and Gillian were starting to do their thing, and you're just looking around the room and everyone is entranced by it, and it's a bit of magic that's happening, and it's that sort of thing, I think, that you you're looking for, I suppose, and that's what keeps us all coming back.
I remember reading Gary Marshall's memoir many, many, many years ago, and he talked about exactly the same thing. I mean, no matter what the genre is, no matter what you're doing, that he found he was unsure of himself. He found the moment, and then he realised all of the crew was just watching it absolutely avidly, what was happening. It doesn't seem to matter what you're making. It's just like those moments seem key.
I think so, and ultimately that is the thing that's at the heart of the business and the process of filmmaking is in the end, You know, you've got a whole lot of people in the dark looking at an image and being, you know, being lost in it, I suppose. And that's the process.
So you said you matched the BBC camera setups and you matched the room. There's one crucial detail from the book that you missed, which was the bit where, if I'm remembering this right, once they'd actually shot the interview, didn't they clear the room to set up a cinema and put something on? The interview room was where the palace showed movies. It's just
that's
like
right.
You could have just got them all cleared out to watch Con Air afterwards or something. They'd love that.
That's right. It was the room that you're absolutely right. The room that they shot the interview in is also the room which, you know, gets converted into being the sort of in-house palace cinema. And I think
incredible.
Sam McAllister will remember, but it was something like Bridget Jones or something like that, I think.
So, I mean, we're nearly out of time, but I mean, one of the interesting things about interviewing a filmmaker a few days after their film has come out is you've had a weekend where this film isn't yours anymore. That I mean, there are reactions, positive and negative, going on all around the world, and everyone seems to have a view on it. This was always going to be an impossible film to quietly slip out into the world. I'm just wondering how you as the human being are now, what your weekend was like, knowing that millions of people were watching this film, and now all of a sudden millions of people have a viewpoint on it. That strikes me as quite a surreal position to be in.
It is, and it's a great position. I mean, the reaction's been phenomenal, and we've had so much positive response to it, and also so many conversations started, and it's a sort of it's a contentious topic, and people have very strong views on it, and you
That's
try
fun,
to
though,
find.
Right?
That is the fun. You try to find a path through the story, and to try to tell a new story, and you know, find your way through it. But yeah, no, it's an amazing process, particularly when you know you have this weird thing when you're making a film where you start on your own with a script, and then gradually more and more people get introduced to it, and suddenly you're months or years later, you're standing on a set with 100 people, and then the filming ends, and all of those people disappear, and it's just you and an editor in a room working away on something, and then you know, more and more people get introduced to the process once again, and you have, you know, orchestras and visual effects people and so on. But it's a sort of odd process between you know, sometimes very isolated and or solitary existence, and then sometimes, you know, a hugely public one. And the last weekend was amazing. We had an incredible launch in London, and then it goes out, as you say, all over the world. You know, and that's the amazing thing about the kind of business of putting a film on Netflix these days, is that, you know, literally everybody on the planet, all the language versions done, all of that sort of stuff has all happened. In the old days, what used to happen was that, you know, you put out a film in say the English language, and then a few months later the different languages would be done. But this, everything happens and it drops and it goes everywhere on the planet, and every single human being who wants to watch this film can watch it very quickly, and you know that's an extraordinary experience.
It must be like making a Jurassic Park sequel, that you start something like that. There must be few films and projects once you come onto at an infancy, at a conceptual stage, where it's guaranteed that people are going to watch it. I mean, without, unless you do something like really, really bizarrely off kilter or something like that, it's guaranteed people are going to watch it. I just wondered, just that you talked about those moments of quiet where it's just you in a room, supplier. Does that change actually any of those mechanics? Do you feel that on your shoulder, or can you just like put that aside when you're in the nuts and bolts of it?
I think we all knew all the way through that when it got out into the world, people would you know, have a strong view on it and want to, you know, and that made us determined to, I guess, on a simple creative level, to do our best with it. And for instance, you know, everybody knows what the palace looks like. Everybody knows what the BBC looks like. And we obviously didn't film inside the palace or didn't film inside the BBC. And so just on a technical, creative or sort of world building level, there's a kind of sense that the film is going to, you know, be compared to news footage, real footage, documentary footage, people's own experiences. They can jump in a cab and go and stand outside Buckingham Palace, and our film has to sort of sustain all of that. So just on a sort of technical level, creative level, storytelling level, you just thought, okay, this is something, this is a world that people know, and we've got to not disappoint them on that front. But also, I think emotionally and narratively, I think the story that we were telling of these three women at the BBC who come together to, if you like, pull off this incredible coup, get an interview, it felt like that was new information, and that would be something that would allow people to look at the story in a new way.
So two quick things before I'm out of time. Number one, back when you were at the start, when you were a script reader, what did you discover anything at that point? Did you discover Goodfellas or something?
No, very sadly, I didn't. you read a lot of you read a lot of scripts, which often scripts are you know quite good in a way. That's the weird. That's the most difficult one to deal with. You read very few things that are absolutely brilliant. You read quite a lot of things that really aren't any good, and it's the sort of middle ground that is, I think, the trickiest area, because actually there's something that's interesting, but kind of kind of extricating that is complicated, you know. Sadly I did not discover Goodfellas or anything like that.
Goes my clickbait from this interview. That's a shame, isn't it? And so finally then, where does this leave you? I mean, you've got a hit movie on your hands. It's been talked about all around the world. What are the projects you want to tackle next? What does this give you an appetite for?
I would love to do something. You know, in the end, as a director, you can deal the cards that you're dealt. And so I'm reading lots of interesting things. My instinct at the moment is to go in a completely fictional direction. I really loved, I really enjoyed making The Whole of Scoop, but one of the bits that I particularly enjoyed was that opening 5 minutes in New York.
I did wonder.
And I really would love just to make something that has its own kinetic, propulsive, sort of thrillerized engine. And it feels like that's such a great kind of filmmaking, actually, that you see less and less these days. All the, if you like, the story dominoes are all hitting each other, and actually one scene kind of creates the next scene, and you just move through things really fast. And I would love to make a complex but kinetic thriller, I think.
I did watch that opening, and I sat there wondering what your All the President's Men or 3 Days of the Condor might look like.
Yes.
It looked like someone having a real treat of a time. Philip Martin, thank you so much for sparing the time to come on this podcast, and congratulations on your worldwide hit movie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was the end of my conversation with Philip Martin. Scoop is available around, as you probably worked out, is available around the world on Netflix now, at the point this podcast is being recorded. It also brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. And as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for listening. If I've not bored you completely, you can find more from me at Simon Brew on Twitter and on Blue Sky. We're at Film Stories on Twitter and Blue Sky as well. If you go to facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, that's where our Facebook page lies. Oddly enough, youtube.com/filmstories. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, you can find our print magazines for sale. Two new ones just launched there as well. Print film magazines. Gotta love them. And then at filmstories.co.uk, that is our website, updated daily with movie news, features, reviews, games, TV, things like that. A clickbait-free entertainment website. That's the the goal at least. But the most important thing now is that you all stay safe and well. I'm going to go off and put together your regular episode of Film Stories. And so until then, look after yourselves, take care, and thank you, as always, for listening. Bye-bye.